Chapter 6. Containment. Lucy glanced across the breakfast table at Dan, who wasn't eating either. Like her, he was hesitating to remove the protective mask. She stared out of the window, transfixed. The sky rippled with mustard-yellow spores drifting in the wind. Lucy's larynx twitched in aversion. "We need to make this apartment airtight," declared Dan from behind his mask and goggles. "Otherwise, we'll starve trying to avoid infection." She considered their building's composition. It was about 30 years old, so built to a pretty decent standard. The balcony on their one external wall was covered in around half a foot of fluffy seeds. Those could be swept off, she figured. It would be a matter of sealing all the windows and doorways and meticulously checking for cracks in the floors or walls. "We'll need a vent, though, with a filter, right?" She cast her eyes around the rest of the kitchen. "And we need to block the sink, all the drains, really, which means no more showers or toilet flushes when the power's on." Dan nodded, following her gaze. "We can find workarounds. Wash up in a bucket and empty it on the street. Stuff like that."
"You mean shit in a bucket, don't you?"
"Hey, I'm fully open to alternatives, but yeah, it's looking that way. Blocking the drains should be doable. We've got some silicone sealant in that cupboard. Reckon that'll be enough to hold the plugs in place?"
"Maybe. What about the overflow holes? Could we get away with just taping over them?"
They set to work, starting with the drains, sealing them up one by one, even sealing off the faucets, too, after turning off their water supply entirely. It was all or nothing, she told herself. Either you eliminated every possible risk of airborne contamination, including the small amount of air pumped through with every turn of the faucet, or you threw it all away. One weakness in your whole plan, and that would be the flaw that killed you. Besides, for the time being, they still had Dan's largely untouched stockpile of water, which they'd been able to replenish during sporadic bouts of power. Once the faucets were sealed, which didn't take long, they commenced the larger operation of sealing off the rest of the apartment. They began with the obvious suspects, windows, window frames, and balcony doors, sealing them with a combination of heavy-duty duct tape and dust sheets from their recent move. Within a couple of hours, the apartment resembled a crime scene. The plastic sheets covering the balcony doors thrashed back and forth with each fluctuation of the wind outside, crackling loudly.
"Shit," said Dan, placing his hand to the side of the door. "You feel that?"
Lucy copied and felt a light breeze tickle her palm. She thumped the wall in frustration.
"God damn it!"
It wasn't airtight. They assessed the situation, looking for their mistake.
"What if we sealed them from the outside?" suggested Dan, pointing to the balcony doors. "We could climb out through the kitchen window."
"And let a bunch of those seed things in while it's open?" frowned Lucy. "No way. Besides, we'd have to step in them too and open the window again to get back in. It's too much of a risk." With no better alternatives available, they added a second layer of shrink wrapping to all of their windows and doors, double taping the seams this time. By early afternoon, they had double sealed off everything apart from the front door. And yet it was all moot if they couldn't address two remaining problems. The issue of creating a filtered air vent and creating an airlock so that they could enter and exit the apartment without compromising it. They sat in silence for a minute, contemplating the next step. Dan's stomach groaned loudly. It had been 16 hours since their last meal.
"My work!" exclaimed Lucy, her eyes all lit up. "How did I not think of it before?"
Dan looked nonplussed. The connection to her advertising job clearly wasn't jumping out at him.
"We were filming a commercial before the satellites failed," she elaborated, "and the cast were in hazmat suits. I think the suits are still at the office."
Dan's eyes lit up. "Are you sure they were real? They weren't just props?"
"No, they're real. We got them on loan from a pesticide company. Come on,"
she said, jumping up and pulling on her jacket, swaying slightly with head rush.
"How will we get there?"
asked Dan, getting to his feet a little more cautiously. Lucy chucked him a bicycle helmet.
"How do you think?"
Her hidden smile pushed the mask upwards at the sides of her face. The 2-mile cycle to Lucy's work was surreal. Visibility had improved since the morning as the number of seeds floating in the wind had eased. But the soft sepia carpet had become damp overnight and slippery. Both Lucy and Dan nearly came off their bikes as they initially underestimated the treachery of the surface. The fluff was reducing to clumps, and the mustard shade turning translucent.
In their haste, neither of them had mentally prepared for the new rows of bodies they'd see lining each street as they passed. The buses were emptier, too, presumably a combination of people staying home out of fear, or their occupants steadily dwindling in number as the disease spread. The most disturbing sight, however, was the collapsed body of a soldier, a crumpled heap of camouflage, his limbs twisted, wrists bent over, fingers sticking out at jarring angles. His tortured face was mostly concealed as it kissed the asphalt beneath his mask. Seeds had begun to land on his uniform, making it hard to judge how long he'd been there. Lucy swallowed grimly, suppressing her vomit reflex, the acidic aftertaste lingering at the back of her mouth long after they'd passed the soldier's wilted body. That his uniform had meant nothing to the disease, that the people here to protect them were themselves just as vulnerable as she was. She shivered and pushed the pedals harder. Most disturbing was that his body hadn't been collected by his fellow soldiers. If the military couldn't survive this thing, then how were the two of them going to make it? They arrived at her workplace, an otherwise deserted stretch of the city. With no residential population here, it was one of the few streets not adorned with corpses. The large glass doors to the lobby were locked shut, so Dan hurled a trash can at them several times. It created an almighty racket. Lucy's relief was immense when the glass finally gave way on the fourth attempt, leaving them free to tiptoe through the shards and inside. The intruder alarm stayed silent, neutered by the lack of electricity. Lucy gave a guilty glance at the empty concierge desk, mentally apologizing to the absent custodians for vandalizing their lobby. They brought the bikes just inside the glass building and propped them up against the internal wall before heading up the main stairs, soon reaching Lucy's company's offices on the third floor. She instinctively tried to swipe her card, which had no effect. Again, Dan smashed the door into the office, this time using a nearby fire extinguisher and succeeding in one deft blow. The glass crunched beneath their feet as they crossed into the otherwise silent space. Her deserted open-plan office stretched before them, filled with defunct Mac Pros, ergonomic desk chairs, and underwatered potted plants. "This way," she said, leading down the central avenue towards a partitioned section at the end. Something in the periphery of her vision moved. "What was that?" she said, spinning round to face the staff lounge.
"What was what?"
said Dan, looking from Lucy to the lounge. "I thought I saw... oh, nothing. It was just a rat, I think. I saw its tail disappearing. It's fine. I'm not scared of them, I just wasn't expecting it. I guess it found the food in the staff kitchen. Come on, this way," she said, continuing forwards.
"Looks like you've got a leak in the staff area. There's water on the floor," said Dan, catching up. "You should get it checked out when this place reopens."
The studio door opened without resistance, revealing an array of green screens, soft boxes, and cameras mounted on tripods, all entirely redundant without power.
"There they are!"
exclaimed Lucy, spotting the props rack to the side of the room where three yellow and white hazmat suits hung in pristine condition, their creased, shiny arms draped limply above the face shields, gloves and black welly boots piled below. She and Dan quickly crossed over to the rack and immediately began kicking off their shoes.
"Wait," said Dan, who was about to plunge a leg into the suit he was holding. "Do these go over our clothes, or are they instead of them?"
Lucy tried to recall how they'd done everything in the advert. "I imagine they'll get pretty hot. They're basically all plastic, so maybe just underwear and a t-shirt?"
"Okay, minimal base layer,"
agreed Dan. He dropped the suit and began wrestling his jeans off. Lucy hesitated for a moment, recalling the order of layers, then began doing the same. The suit shell was essentially a plasticized onesie, a single garment from top to toe. Lucy pulled each leg on, then the arms, wriggling the top half over her shoulders and into place before pulling the front zipper up from her navel to her chin. "Like this." She reached across and tucked Dan's zipper beneath the Velcro safety flap on the collar. "Grab a mask and goggles," she said, pointing him to the three piles on the floor.
Haven't they been used?"
he hesitated. "Only way before the outbreak. They're better quality than these, though, surely," she said, tapping her existing mask. "You ready?" She picked up two of the specialist breathing filters and handed one to Dan.
"Ready,"
he confirmed. They ripped off their cheap face masks and goggles, discarding them onto the floor by their shoes. Lucy wrestled the new face mask over her nose and mouth. It was thicker and marginally harder to breathe through.
The goggles, however, were a definite improvement. Broader than a snorkeling mask, they significantly improved her field of vision compared to the narrow, misty swimming pair she'd set off with.
"All good?" asked Dan, adjusting his straps.
"I think so," said Lucy, still adapting to the new breathing filter. "Hood's next," she added, pulling hers on. The elastic lip kept the hood snug about her forehead and cheeks, fully covering her hairline and ears. She grabbed the long rubber gloves and pulled a pair on while Dan fussed over his hood positioning. They were as long as her forearm.
"You tape me in, and then I'll do you," she said, passing him some silver duct tape.
He taped around both glove holes, just below the elbow, so that each glove was properly sealed to her suit. Lucy swiftly reciprocated, sealing Dan in. They both affixed the hard plastic visors which shielded their faces from ear to ear, extending from forehead to below the chin. Lastly, they pulled on a pair of black wellies each, taping them to their suit legs.
"How do you like my new threads?"
said Dan, strutting around her in a circle. Lucy laughed.
"You look ridiculous."
"What? I look sick. I look like a riot cop," he added with a proud nod, still strutting.
"You look like a beekeeper," she retorted.
"How's your breathing?" she asked, noticing the slight mist her breath generated against the inside of her visor.
"Fine, though these boots are a little small. What do you want to do about our clothes?"
he replied, pointing to the discarded pile next to them. Approaching voices made them both spin around.
"People!"
hissed Lucy, her heart rate soaring. The voices were close enough to be in the open plan office now.
"Quickly!"
urged Lucy, heading straight for the emergency exit on the far side of the studio. The voices got closer still, with shouts of,
"Hello?"
echoing through the hallway. Lucy kicked the emergency exit bar open. The door swung out onto the fire escape, hitting the railing behind with a clang and bouncing back. Catching the rebound with her hand, she leapt out onto the small platform, turning to check Dan was with her.
"Dan, quick!"
she cried as the two figures burst into the studio. Rapidly limping towards them was her boss, Miles, with his petite blonde girlfriend glued to his elbow.
"Hey!" yelled Miles, leading the advance. His voice was muffled by a face mask, but his eyes were daggers and his fists balled. "Stop right there! This is private prop!"
It wasn't clear whether he'd recognize them or not in the suits, but Lucy was willing to bet that at this stage, it wouldn't make a difference. He needed the suits as much as they did.
"Go!"
she cried, slamming the fire door shut. Dan threw himself at the rusty fire escape ladder, and Lucy followed. The cumbersome attire hampered their speed. Dan jumped the last few steps and landed on the steel platform below with a clatter, prompting Lucy to copy.
"Come on!"
he shouted back, already starting down the next level. Lucy kept as close as possible without crushing his retreating hands underfoot. The studio fire exit crashed open again with a clang. Lucy scrambled down the steps as fast as she could, glancing up to see Miles stumbling out onto the platform above. He glared over the edge at them, and for a split second, she thought she saw recognition in his eyes before he vanished. The clattering of rapid footsteps on the ladder above signaled the hunt was on as he began to chase after them. Lucy looked back down and concentrated on the descent. Dan had reached the last rungs of the bottom ladder, and it was a big drop now. He hit the solid ground below with a thud, but managed to stay on both feet.
"Come on, Luce!"
he yelled, gesturing for her to jump. She looked up and saw Miles' hand sweep over the side of the platform two levels up as he raced to the next ladder. She cast her eyes downward again and jumped, Dan catching her as she stumbled forward. He grabbed her hand and they ran towards the front of the building.
"Look!" cried Lucy as they rounded the corner. "That's Miles' car," she said, pointing at the stationary vehicle across the road. "It wasn't there before." "How the hell is he still driving?"
cried Dan, gasping for breath as they charged back into the lobby.
"No idea! Watch the glass!"
shouted Lucy as they darted over to their bikes and ripped them from the wall.
"Hey, stop!"
yelled a voice from above them in the lobby. Jennifer was at the top of the stairs, clutching the third hazmat suit.
"I said stop!"
she screamed, all timidity vanishing as she hurried down the stairs toward them. Dan hurled both bikes outside, over the shards, and the pair scrambled after them.
"Let's go!"
he yelled, snatching his bike from the ground and leaping onto it. Lucy didn't need telling twice. The pair took off fast, hurtling down the slippery sidewalk and onto the road. Dan swerved to the side a little bit as he looked over his shoulder.
"Okay, this is bad,"
he cried as she pulled level. Lucy glanced backward. Miles had made it down the fire escape, and now he and Jennifer were converging on the car. "This way!" yelled Dan, pulling ahead again and swerving left. The engine of Miles' car revved ominously, projecting his fury down the street. Dan hooked onto a side street that was too narrow for cars. Lucy followed him, barely avoiding skidding off the bike as she took the corner at top speed, pulling her front wheel up as they mounted the sidewalk. The sound of tires screeching echoed around the otherwise silent district as Miles released his handbrake, hurtling down the slushy road towards them. Lucy kept glancing backward as they sped down the alleyway, her hot, rapid breathing fogging up the visor. Miles' car raced past the turn they'd taken out of sight, audibly skidding around the parallel block. The light at the end of the alleyway grew closer as the pair pedaled desperately, racing to emerge before Miles could cut them off. A series of gunshots rang out from ahead, followed by the screech of car brakes under immense strain. A military truck sped past the back street opening, giving a fleeting glimpse of three uniformed soldiers, the last of whom was mounting the gun turret. Dan slammed on his brakes. Lucy did the same, and they came to a stop just yards from the opening. Not daring even to peer out of the alley, Lucy looked at Dan and suddenly realized how conspicuous their outfits were.
"Miles could be telling the patrol we stole the suits," she gasped.
"We've got to turn back," said Dan, struggling to regulate his volume in the panic. Lucy spun her bike around, setting off the way they'd come, her legs screaming from oxygen debt. She pushed on, forcing the cranks around until she reached the original entrance to the passage again. Stopping, she peered out cautiously into the street ahead. It was deserted.
"You lead," gasped Dan. "You know this area best."
More than an hour passed as they weaved through a patchwork of slippery, undulating back streets, avoiding the main roads.
"Dan," said Lucy, halting atop a hilly road overlooking the water. "Look, the beach."
Covering the sand were piles of dead, washed-up marine life, all coated in glistening yellow liquid. The yellow waters were themselves now textured by a layer of fluffy golden seeds growing on top. The seeds drifted inland in their thousands as the wind scooped up the never-ending supply and spread it across the city.
"You hear that?"
said Lucy as a chopping sound approached. A helicopter came into view. It was flying slowly and trailing a rigid cable a few meters above the water's surface.
"What is that?" she asked, squinting.
"It looks like they're dropping something into the water. Maybe a pesticide or something," said Dan, peering out with his hand raised to his brow. The helicopter began a vertical climb of several hundred feet and retracted the cable. A bright light appeared on the open side of the helicopter as a flare was tossed downward, tumbling through the air. The second it hit the water surface, the entire seafront erupted in flame. The helicopter took off out of sight as Lucy and Dan stared on in amazement. The flames, meters tall, engulfed the oily yellow scum, cloaking the coastline in fire and thick black smoke.
"You reckon that's gonna work?"
asked Lucy, as her eyes glazed over, mesmerized by the lapping flames.
"I reckon it's gonna wipe out the pier," said Dan, turning his bike around and pushing off.
As they continued their improvised route home, it became clear that the seafront wasn't the only place fire was being tactically deployed. Lucy and Dan watched as the military used a flamethrower to burn seeds that had been piled up in the middle of a residential street. A fire truck stood on duty, ready to intervene, while the surviving residents watched on fearfully from their doorsteps, many with wrapped bodies at their feet. The hazmat suits made for sweaty work. Lucy and Dan's rate of pedaling had dropped significantly now that they were clear of Miles. Lucy was keen to keep her breathing rate low whenever possible to avoid exacerbating the mask's resistance. As they locked their bikes up at the side of their building later that afternoon, Lucy's eye was drawn to the paving.
"What the... Dan? Is this stuff growing?"
"Don't get too close," he warned, as Lucy knelt down to investigate. Protruding through the mustard-colored layer of spores was a sapling. It was wet, and its green-yellow leaves were covered in beads of moisture.
"That makes no sense," said Lucy, standing back up. "It's got to be nearly 5 o'clock, and this area's been in the sun for the whole afternoon, yet the ground's still wet, and this plant's wet."
"No," she corrected quickly. "The ground's dry. It's the seeds that are wet."
"Maybe they retain moisture," suggested Dan, who had remained standing up.
A lot of plants do.
Not on the outside, they don't, she countered. Not in direct sunlight and to this extent.
Maybe it's not water, then, considered Dan. It could be something else, something that doesn't evaporate as easily.
Voices sounded nearby. Dan immediately pressed himself flush against the wall, and Lucy copied. Two neighbors from their building were carrying out a body. From the age gap, they looked to be father and son, although the face masks made the relationship harder to judge. Neither man paid her or Dan the slightest bit of attention, too preoccupied as they were with the disposal of what was presumably a family member. The younger man, who looked around 30, put a hand on the other man's shoulder, as the latter visibly shook with grief, surveying the body he'd laid out. The pair stood like that for a long minute before the son delicately led the father back into the building. Dan held them in position for a further minute. Before they entered their building, they painstakingly wiped the soles of their hazmat suits onto the slimy entrance mat. "We're going to need to think of an alternative to this," noted Dan, looking at the sodden mat. They repeated the immaculate wiping routine again on the 8th floor, checking each other's soles for seeds at least 3 times before they felt safe entering their home. When they finally got into their apartment, the last of Lucy's adrenaline wore off. She slumped, sliding her back down the wooden door until she sat, legs splayed out on the floor before her. Her head pounded with thirst and hunger. Dan similarly succumbed to exhaustion and slumped adjacent to her.
"We can't do it like this," mumbled Lucy. "We need to drink and eat. There's no point in having these suits if we starve inside them. I think we need to risk taking them off."
"What we need," considered Dan dozily, "is a canary."
"What?"
"Like miners used to have. They'd have a canary in the mine, which would die when the gas levels got dangerous. We need something like that in here. A pet, something that we can use to gauge if the air's safe to breathe or not. The disease kills everything, right? So if we've got, like, a budgie in here, and it's alive, then we can assume the air's safe."
"What if we take our suits off, then the budgie dies?" countered Lucy. "Then it's too late to save ourselves."
"So we wait. 3 hours. That's what the radio said."
"They said 24, corrected Lucy.
"Yeah, but 3 if it's gonna kill you. If we've got a canary and it's still alive 3 hours after we get back, then we'd know the air's safe, right?"
"What if our canary just so happens to have a natural resistance that we don't?" frowned Lucy.
"Then we're screwed," conceded Dan. "But we're also screwed if we don't eat or drink. So, on balance,
it's worth the risk," completed Lucy. She nodded, looking around their partially sealed apartment. It made sense. Without a vent and an airlock, they needed some other indication of the air's viability.
"Where are we going to get a canary from?" she asked, dreading the answer as she pictured them trying to break into a pet shop of different starving animals.
"The Spanish woman from downstairs," said Dan, renewed purpose in his voice. "I bet you she had a pet, a cat or something."
"But she had the disease."
"She might have caught it when she was out. She had her key in her hand, right? So she was returning to the apartment, not leaving it. Maybe she's got a pet in there that's still alive."
It was worth a try, for sure. Lucy hauled her fatigued body up from the ground as Dan marched off into the bedroom determinedly, returning with 2 flashlights. Lucy retrieved the Spanish lady's bleached key from the sideboard where they'd left it the night before and steeled herself.
"Okay, let's do it."
The door opened with a click. She checked Dan was still close by her shoulder, then gently pushed it open.
"Hello?"
she called out, hoping desperately there'd be no reply. Lucy took a few steps into the deserted apartment, and as she did, so began to notice details of the dead woman's life. The windows were covered by thin, white embroidered curtains, the sort of ornate patterns that were all the rage a century ago. Hanging on the walls were a number of religious artifacts, crucifixes, pictures of the Virgin Mary, and figurines of assorted saints. In the corner, next to the TV, was a small prayer stool with a gospel resting on the shelf. Manuela had clearly been a devout woman. On the kitchen counter were 2 packets of medication. "Take 2 tablets daily, orally, with water," said Lucy, reading one of the labels aloud.
"Are you paying attention?" snapped Dan. We're on a mission here.
She mentally swore at him, but didn't pick a fight, knowing that he had a point. She placed the tablets back down and explored the apartment further. The woman's bedroom was almost completely pitch black. The curtains were fully drawn and the lights were out. Standing on the threshold and peering in, Lucy cast her flashlight around the room.
She jumped and backed up a few paces as a scuffling noise from the dark corner startled her. Bullseye! Cheered Dan, appearing by her side and shining his light onto the terrified-looking hamster. I knew she'd have a pet! He chimed triumphantly, walking towards the cage and swearing loudly as he marched his shin into the side of the bed.
I'll get it, you point the lights, said Lucy, handing him her flashlight and taking over as Dan nursed his shin. Lucy moved the hamster cage into the middle of the main room, and they hunted for the woman's stash of pet food. The pathetic ball of fur looked as hungry as they were, and they needed it to not die.
What kind of grown woman keeps a pet hamster anyway? Asked Dan as they rifled through Manuela's cupboards.
I take it back, he said immediately. She's got Twinkie bars. She's a saint. Rest in peace, Manuela, bringer of Twinkies.
Knock it off, Dan, grumbled Lucy. You should respect the dead, especially in their own home. Now let's go, she said, standing up with the cage in one hand and an armful of pet food in the other. We can always come back down if we need more.
Fine,
said Dan, stuffing Twinkies into a box of cereal he'd also decided to appropriate.
Make sure we stick it by the front door, yeah? We want to be able to see him right when we get in. Oh, and shotgun choosing the name. I name you.
He paused while Lucy walked towards the door with scathing indifference.
Madonna. The Virgin Hamster.
Presumably. I don't know. Maybe this guy got laid a lot in high school. Or girl, I really don't know much about hamsters.
Lucy pressed on without responding, carrying Madonna, the Virgin Hamster, upstairs, with Twinkie Cereal Boy in tow. She stepped back and let Dan open the door.
Welcome to your new home, Madonna, she said, crossing the threshold.
Please don't be infected.